This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to the Rabble Book Lounge, a production of Rabble.ca. I'm Victoria Fenner, executive producer of the Rabble Podcast Network. In today's interview, author Sally Miller talks about something which is all too familiar to me. Her research for her new book, Belongings, The Fight for Land and Food, included conversations with farmers in southern Ontario. A lot of them spoke about the need for off-farm jobs because they couldn't support families on farming alone. I can relate. I can recall a phone call in 1962 to our house from Chrysler's in Windsor asking my dad to come in for an interview. He was planning to work in the factory for just a couple of years until the farm economy got better. He retired 30 years later. And it hasn't gotten better for most farmers unless they become large-scale farmers with thousands of acres of land, not 100 tiny acres like we had. Sally Miller looks at land ownership and conflict, food insecurity, and some possible solutions. Wayne McPhail spoke to Sally for the Rabble Book Lounge. Here's their conversation.
So Sally, you, in your book, you talk a lot about how land is tied to a lot of different kinds of conflicts in the world. Can you say a little bit of what you mean by that?
Well, if you're looking at it globally, I would say that the commodification of land is leading to the crisis of access to food and access to land to grow your food across the world. I mean, I think it's important both to realize that these fights are going on around the world. So you have landless movement in Brazil, people who have been pushed off the land by corporate agriculture and development are occupying land just to grow food for their families, and very exciting. Also, very violent. People are being killed trying to get back on their traditional lands all over the world. I think it's important, though, to turn the lens on what happens in Canada as well, because although there may not be as much violence involved with it, we are seeing people losing access to land to grow food. We've got just around the Greater Golden Horseshoe, where we have 50% of the best farmland in all of Canada, we have 10 to 17% of hunger right now. And then if you go up north, you've got First Nations and some northern communities over 50% hunger, and that affects children more. So we're obviously not, our food system is not working. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that land has been put into the economic system as a commodity and is sold to the for the highest value, which means it's often taken out of farming and put into development, urban sprawl, mining, transportation, eight-lane highways, pretty much anything besides growing food.
So one of the things that was kind of depressing when I read your book was, and it's a quote from you early on where you talked to a lot of farmers in Ontario, and I'm not sure exactly what you were hoping to get, but what you got instead, and I'm quoting here, is, "Instead, I was saddened by the clarity of despair of farmers and reminded that the situation is indeed a crisis." So that's fairly bleak. And that comes from talking to a lot of farmers in Ontario?
My writing in general, I'm out there looking for solutions and looking particularly for the people who are dealing with the crisis to talk about what they think needs to happen and coalitions that they're already forming and building. And I was brought up short by how bad the situation is for farmers. And, you know, to the extent that they have this sort of macabre joke that a lot of them wanted to tell me about the farmer who, do you know this one? Mm-hmm. Probably do, you might have gotten to that in the book, but the farmer who won the lottery, mm-hmm. He's asked by a reporter what he's going to do with all that money, and he says, "I'm going to farm till it's gone."
Right.
You know, yeah. Ha, ha, ha. But what that really means is that farming isn't viable, and people mm-hmm. are doing it. There's even where we have some of the best soils and farmland right around Toronto, people are supporting their farms by off-farm income, which is crazy. So we're depending on farmers to grow food for us. And they, out of the goodness of their hearts, are taking second and third jobs in order to keep their farm going.
Right. Yeah, and one of the other quotes you have in the book is that farmers live poor and die rich.
Die rich, right? Yeah. What farmers receive for the food that they grow, in real dollars, hasn't changed since the 70s, right. Whereas inputs have gone up. We know that consumers are paying more for food, but that money is not going to the farmers. And that's one of the problems, is that people think it's the farmers' fault. The farmers are not getting any more. All the other costs, cost of land, cost of any inputs has gone up, cost of transporting it to the markets. So what farmers have done, they do a couple of things. They get into massive debt in order to keep farming. And the only way they can pay off that debt, the most valuable asset they have is their land. And like an urban homeowner, they have a right, because of the way we've set up private property, they have a right to sell it to the highest bidder. We can't say to farmers, well, no, you can't do what our urban homeowner thinks about, you know, people all the time talk about how the market value of their house has gone up in Toronto. So why shouldn't farmers be able to do that? And the farmers are in, you know, they're up to their eyeballs in debt, and they call the land their only pension, and they have to sell it. They don't want to. I mean, and that's where the sadness comes in. The farmers don't want it to go like this. So the question is, what do we do to help support their real relations to land, so that they can keep on doing what they want to do?
And so part of the result of that, I think, is as you say in your book, that you're getting bigger farms.
So there has been a push from the federal government through subsidies and programs and things to encourage consolidation. Mm-hmm. And in 1969, there was actually a federal task force in agriculture, so there were too many Canadian farmers. So this is actually like a long-term plan. Mm-hmm. And it is one way, if you're a farmer in this situation of debt and frozen prices that I'm talking about, one way to stay alive is to get more land and expand. And as the small farms go under because they can't handle the situation, then people start buying them up. And there are farms that are doing really well, like where we have supply management, so where we actually make sure the farmers are getting a fair price. So dairy, chicken, and things like that, the farmers actually do well. So when you see, like, we had a crash in the beef industry when we had the BSE scare. What happened was a lot of beef farmers went out of business, but the dairy and the chicken farmers can then take that land. So they were able to expand and needed to in order to succeed. But I would say one thing I think that we don't realize in Ontario is that the average acreage is actually under 300. Which is not very big. Like, right. If you look in Western Canada, the average is much larger. What we have in Ontario is actually still mid-scale farms. But the problem is that the programs and things like crop insurance and stuff like that are geared towards large-scale, commercial, export-oriented. Mm-hmm. But we have the resources and the capacity still here to if we stop selling things off to urban sprawl, we have the capacity to have a good food system and feed ourselves in Ontario.
So I just want to come back to something you said about that, you know, it's almost a government plan to reduce the number of farmers. And I think that's almost counterintuitive. You would think if you want to feed a bigger population, if you want a growing population overseas that you're feeding and supplying stuff, so you would want more farmers, right?
Well, you want fewer farmers with larger amounts of land. Hmm. So that was the general push. The idea was that it would be more efficient if, rather than having a farmer with 700 acres here and another with 250, that you have 2,000, 3,000 acre farms. Hmm. And that would be considered more efficient. But it's an assumption that in some ways is not really proven. I mean, I would hypothesize that around 100 acres, you're looking at a viable business if you have access to regional markets and the things that make an agricultural economy work.
Right. But one of the things, you point out in your book, is that when you have those bigger farms, it makes it less desirable to be near them, right? Because you're spreading liquid manure and having to drive from one place to the other, and it just doesn't become very conducive to that kind of shared land use that would make it possible to have a local economy, right?
It's particularly not compatible for people who are not from the rural community and who move out there, and that they expect they have a sort of pastoral vision of what it's going to be like to live in the countryside. So there's a lot of conflict that's happening because people are moving out of the cities and have a kind of dream of what it's going to be like. Another challenge that comes from that, that I talked about in the book, that I really kind of got from the sort of key message from the farmers, is they need other farmers around them. They need farm supply nearby. They need large animal vets nearby if they're doing livestock. And part of what's happening by selling these plots of farmland off to urban people who want a rural estate is that they're losing that community. And actually, the way their profession works is actually very hard to do on your own. You actually need
that infrastructure.
There's all these, the infrastructure, and also there's all these exchanges. I mean, they make exchanges of land, equipment. They help, they'll share machine repair facilities. There's a study in the U.S. that shows that for every acre that gets developed, you lose 3 acres of farmland because the farmers will move out of the area because they no longer have what they need.
And in the Holland Marsh area, if I recall, there's a lot of bartering, there's a lot of help across the farms, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is from more recent research I've done, but they share machine repair and machine construction because they realize that because they've got this heavy muck soil, because it's a drained wetland.
It's a marsh.
Yeah, it's a marsh. They actually have to build their own tractors and combines and everything, because if they take them off the shelf from John Deere or something, they just sink. So they have to have these sort of big tires, and they have specialists who know how to fix them. But that's not that unusual. Like, I found that you know, most farmers know how to fix their machinery. And I had one young farmer say to me, you know, my problem in becoming really a successful farmer is that I don't know how to fix machinery. It's just not one of my skills. So right. I have to go find someone to do it for me.
I mean, that sort of ties in this idea of having a history of knowing how to repair stuff and keeping it up and stuff. And the bartering and sharing of land comes back, I think, to another point that you bring up in your book, which I thought was really interesting, is the idea that land has a story, right? Mm-hmm. And if you lose that connection with the land and the connection with the story, you lose an awful lot, right?
Yeah, and I think that's actually where we could make links between the urban ways of thinking about land and the rural ways, because in fact, when you start to talk to people in detail about their relationship to the land, it's stories, it's the things that they remember that happened in different places, it's the years, you know, farmers of course have an intense experience with the climate, and they will give you these stories about what's happened year after year after year in different places. And I think one of the things that moved me the most when I talked to people about getting to a point where they knew they were going to have to sell the land was that they felt they were letting down generations. To be the one in 2016 that has to sell it because you can't make it viable anymore is heartbreaking.
So when you did all your research, did you come away from the idea of land and what's happening to it in a positive way or a negative way? Do you think it's going in a good direction?
I think this is our job. I think we have to figure out what the solutions are and start. That's what the story of the book is. We have this crisis. We need to start rethinking how we relate to land and food.
That was Sally Miller, author of Belongings, The Fight for Land and Food, published by Fernwood Publishing. For more about the book, you can go to www.fernwoodpublishing.ca. Thanks to Wayne McPhail for sending us his interview for the Rabble Book Lounge. The Rabble Book Lounge is a production of Rabble.ca. I'm Victoria Fenner. Thanks for listening.